Inside of You is brought to you by Rocket Money.
I love Rocket Money. You know why? Because everyone should have Rocket Money because it just helps you save money. How many times do we have subscriptions that we don't even know we have anymore and we're paying so much money? It's just throwing away money, Ryan.
I found one.
You did it. You told me. I got Rocket Money.
Okay, I found one. I'm embarrassed to say how long it's been going on, but thank you for finding it. My God. It was embarrassing.
Yeah, because it's like you want to watch some show and you go, I have to subscribe to this this streaming whatever. Mm-hmm. And you start streaming the show, you watch it, you leave, and you forget after this trial period it kicks in and they're charging you $10 a month. It is embarrassing.
Ugh.
You know, 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about. Before I started using Rocket Money, I thought I had, you know, like, oh, I have like 5 subscriptions. I could not believe it when they showed me I was paying for like 4 extra between, you know, streaming devices and fitness apps, delivery services. It's never ending. And thanks to Rocket Money, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features.
Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lowering your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. And I like that.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/inside. That's rocketmoney.com/inside. rocketmoney.com/inside. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. And I hope you listen to the new podcast, In Love with Michael Rosenbaum and Chris Sullivan on iTunes, which aired Monday. We love your support, and to subscribe and write a review would be just really, really awesome. Today's guest is a good friend of mine. He was in Guardians of the Galaxy 2 with me, much bigger part. He had a huge part in 1 as well. He's been in lots of movies. You know him from the Gilmore Girls. He's the brother of James Gunn, the director, and one of my best friends. Sean has become one of my best friends. He really gets deep. In this episode, we talk about his father and his father sick and how it's affected him. And then 2 weeks later, his father passed. Big Jimmy Gunn passed away. And this episode is dedicated to him. He was loved by everyone who met him. Just a heart of gold, a laughter that was contagious. He made you feel like you were very special anytime you talked to him. He was one of the few friends' fathers that I texted. My friend Tom Lally, my best friend in the world, I text his dad and Big Tommy, and I text Big Jimmy Gunn. Sean gets into a lot of great stuff today, dark stuff. He talks about his health and how he almost died, and he talks about being the youngest, and he talks about being on the Gilmore Girls, and then it got canceled, and it ended, I guess. And he was kind of broke and lost his house, and a lot of stuff I think everybody can relate to. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Please subscribe to In Love with Michael Rosenbaum and Chris Sullivan, because I really love this. God, if I could just do these jobs, just doing a podcast and talking to you guys every day, man, that'd be a dream, brother. Let's get inside of Sean Gunn.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience. How do you feel about listening to yourself, Sean?
I don't mind it too much.
Really?
Yeah, I know. My voice is a little bit weird, but...
Well, maybe that's what makes you so damn interesting when you play these different roles, like Kirk from the Gilmore Girls and like this eccentric, and then you play like Kraglin and Guardians. You get
right.
It's cool when your voice is a little different. Like Walken has a, you know, that distinct, yeah, you know, it does this. And if you have your own thing.
I would love that if people, you know, people doing imitations of you.
It's kind of a compliment.
You know, you've made it. Yeah. If somebody was playing me on Saturday Night Live, I'd be like, my career is probably going pretty well.
Yeah. I don't think people like, they try to do impressions of me like you or your brother. And it's more like, hey, I'm Rosenbaum. I'm cool.
Now, your voice is very sort of
boring.
Not boring. But it's very sort of, you know, standard English. Like it's very like Midwest. You're Midwestern, but you're also the the timbre of your voice and everything is it is pretty
unoriginal,
bland. No.
I knew it was coming. If you know a gun, you know that they got a point at you.
I can't help.
No, it's good. It's good. I appreciate it. You know, you said something when we started talking when you came in the house. Mm-hmm. First, I said, "God, you've been here a million times." You're like, "Actually, no, I haven't. I've been here once or twice."
Yeah.
And we used to play Mafia.
That's right.
And how would you explain Mafia in one sentence or two?
It's a parlor game, which I like being able to call it a parlor game,
right.
But that I think gained its peak in Hollywood somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago. And it's really just a game designed to pit people against one another to try to prove their own intelligence over other people. It can be fun, but I think it was also like, it's not a coincidence that it coincided with the poker boom, because Hollywood people can be very competitive in ways that are secretive. And
yeah, you articulate what you just did off the cuff was pretty good, because I don't think I could because I would say, oh, there's townsfolk and there's mafia, and the mafia invade the city and this town, and there's good people and there's bad people, and it gets a little
I think I answered your question more from a cultural perspective than actual,
yes, you did.
What is the game?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the game itself is very much, I think it was popular in Hollywood because we're actors and try to fool people and show how good you are.
It got really, I definitely think that, you know, you, James, and I, and Yarvo, and some of these guys, Yarvo directed Brightburn, and, It was one of those things where we were doing it right at the beginning of it. We were really, it was at my house. It was at James's house. It was, it would get so heated to the point where I remember James, we were so heated, and he's like, "You're a fucking liar. You're a liar." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" I was like, "You're a terrible actor. Then he stopped. He goes, "I take that back. You're a good actor, but fuck you." It was just, it was, and then afterwards you apologize. Because, no, dude, yeah. It got to the point where, like, I think we actually tried this about a year ago at James's house, your sibling, and Jen, his girlfriend.
Yes.
And we played there. Were you there that night?
Probably not.
And I remember Jen was getting really uncomfortable. People get uncomfortable if they're not, if they don't like loud people like me, like James, we're loud.
Yes.
And we're, a little boisterous.
And you're alphas.
I guess
as people might say. I'm not sure I subscribe to that idea that there are alphas and betas as people. But if I did, you are certainly one alpha.
Really?
And I think James is definitely an alpha as well.
Oh, yeah,
obviously. I don't think you can be a director if you're not an alpha.
No, you sort of have to be. But, there's times when, I don't know. I mean, as a director, the amount of responsibility, especially the responsibility that he has now with all these things, it's like, you really have to know what you're fucking doing. And if you don't, you sort of have to fake it, or you have to defer to these great people around you. So surround yourself with great people. And I think Spielberg always says that. And where they just surround themselves with guys that they know are going to come through.
Yeah.
And they can help them figure shit out. Because no one can be that genius where every problem is solved by them.
Right.
You have to have a committee. You have to have some people that kind of help you out.
My dad always used to say that his success was due to the fact that he never hired anyone dumber than him.
Wow. That's
which
smart.
Was probably not true. It's probably more just something to say. But that point of view of, like, make sure you surround yourself with people who are good at their jobs and know what they're doing. Jimmy's really, really good at that.
You said Jimmy. I always say Jimmy. You and I are the only one that call him Jimmy? Who else calls him Jimmy?
Well, all my siblings do.
They do.
For the most part, yeah. So, I've always called him Jimmy, and I don't see any reason to stop calling him Jimmy just because he's, and he introduced himself as James. But I think he now enjoys the fact that, like, he can bestow upon someone the honor of being able to call him Jimmy.
Right.
Now it's like a gift he can give them. It's like, it's okay if you call me Jimmy.
you talk about, like, your dad always he said, never hire anyone dumber than him. Always smarter. I do that in different ways. I've always surrounded myself with really good people. And for a long time, I felt like I did that. And I still do, because I didn't like myself. I know it sounds fucked, but I didn't really love myself. And I'm learning too. And it's kind of cool to just go, hey, dude, whatever you've done, whatever flaws you have, whatever you think you're not, girls that I've dated would say, I think I want to date you because you're friends.
Well, let me tell you. So, and I said to you when I came in the door that I'm a big fan of this podcast. And I mean that sincerely. I've listened to like over half the episodes for sure.
Oh, and, I love you.
And it's also, it's not only is, does it do, so, does it, do I feel like you're doing something interesting here, but also it's particularly good for actors and actors like me who feel sort of part of the fellowship of being somebody who's in the entertainment industry and has been in the business, for a long time. But one thing I've noticed about you is that you tend to sort of fall back. It's clear to me from listening to you a lot that you were that you were told that you weren't very smart growing up, or that you believed that you weren't, and that it was something that was just sort of ingrained in you because, like, probably you got shitty grades or whatever it was.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've said that, you know, your dad would berate you for not like knowing more in school and stuff like that.
Sure.
But I also think that it's something that you're obviously an incredibly smart guy. I learned when I was very young, because I was always told how smart I was. Like, I was the opposite. Everyone was always like, you've got this amazing brain. And I would like test through the roof and things like that. And yeah. But I learned pretty young, you know, my brother Matt, who's only a couple years older than me.
Political producer, right?
Yeah. He's a writer for Real Time with Bill Maher. Right. And he's incredibly bright. But when we were growing up, I noticed that I was the one who was like I'm smart and I have all these math abilities and things. Matt, you know, it takes him a little longer, and not that he's slow, but like he has a learning disability. There were things in school, he didn't get grades that were as good, but I learned pretty quickly that was bullshit. I mean, intelligence shows itself in many different ways. And I'd get to high school and know that I sort of felt uncomfortable and weird and was not super popular. And here's my brother, who's supposed to be the not smart one. And he's like super popular and super smart and can navigate people and can form relationships with adults and his peers in a way that I couldn't. And I'm like, maybe what people are telling me is intelligence is sort of nonsense, and that intelligence is something actually much more complicated than all that. And I know now, growing, you know, as an adult, that that's definitely true, that intelligence manifests itself in many different ways. And so I don't want to take away your shtick of saying, oh no, I'm an idiot. You'll need to do that sometimes, but you're a really bright guy.
Well, you know what? I've learned in therapy to take things in and say, you know, just listen and hear what people say and don't just discard it or run away from it or be embarrassed by it. And I'm learning to just kind of look you in the eye and go, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. It's kind of you. It's very hard for me.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
It is, because, you know, you're right. You said something a few minutes ago. You said when you're ingrained, like you're ingrained as a child with a perception of yourself, you know. And again, I don't sit here saying, you know, going on about how bad my parents were. I didn't feel certain things.
Sure.
I didn't feel that I was smart. I felt that, you know, I was called, hey, dummy, how do you not know this? Hey, there's things in your life, teachers, and you start to believe it. After a while, you believe that, well, my grades aren't good. People think I'm not that smart. They're not listening to me. No one listens to what I have to say. No one cares about my opinion. And my parents don't even think I'm smart. So then you're definitely like, wow, if you get to that point, I don't know. I think I just hid behind always be trying to be someone I was. I think at a young age, I got self-esteem. I've talked about this. I got self-esteem and approval from doing a play, and people just, I remember this popular kid, I always tell the story, but he just says, hey, you're funny. That was it. Mm-hmm. Self-esteem goes up, approval goes up, and that's what I've been striving for my entire life. And that's not self-worth, because that is, you know, the colander effect. It's like a colander, the water just goes right through it. And, you know, it's just what, wasn't until recently that I'm starting to understand that, like what you said, intelligence isn't just, hey, I got great grades, or I'm an SAT master, because I wasn't good at either of those things. Mm-hmm. I'm not even great about taking directions. If somebody says, I want you to do this, I'm like, I always feel stupid. It's weird. Like I start to get this anxiety and this like numbness when I feel like, I don't know what that person's saying. Oh my God, I'm going to be ridiculed. I feel stupid. I'm starting to realize maybe like I couldn't have, if I'm that dumb, then I couldn't memorize all those lines, or I couldn't go direct a movie, or I couldn't. I'm starting to give myself a little bit of credit now. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
And I really am, because I'm like, okay, you're not obviously not stupid.
Yeah. And you didn't luck into this stuff. I mean, look, you live in a beautiful house. I'm sure there's plenty of things you want in your career that you haven't gotten, but there's a heck of a lot that you have gotten, and you're
gratitude.
You're respected for the work that you've done. It's not like you know what I mean? And so, like, all these things are things that you didn't accidentally trip and fall into. It took some intelligence to make the world that you want.
I think we live in a society, I mean, not even a society, but like, everybody's wrong. Everybody's this. You're stupid if you say this. And how do you find? I'm like the kind of guy that's just off the cuff, that just sort of speaks his mind. And sometimes it's like, well, maybe if you just shut up and think about what you're saying, you won't sound stupid. You know what I mean? Because I think I put my foot in my mouth quite often. And I think because I speak, you know, how I feel. And sometimes how you feel is, I don't know if necessarily feel, I don't know how you translate that, but you know, you're a very calm person for the most part. I haven't seen you lose your shit. I haven't seen you lose your shit.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you did. I mean, I know your family. I know your parents. I know
sure.
And I know your dad. It's no secret. He drank.
Oh, yeah.
As a kid. And were you privy to that? Were you?
No, he quit right around the time I was born, but he didn't get help for it till he was a little older. So a lot of that, you know, what people talk about, being a dry drunk, where you maybe technically sort of quit drinking, but you haven't gotten any help or any counseling for it. And so you kind of still display all of those same characteristics that an alcoholic might have. I'm very familiar with that part of my dad. And he also had pill problems and, like, you know, would take stuff for his back and things like that. And so I remembered all that until he got help for it when I was like a teenager. And there was a very clear change in my life and in my upbringing from that point on. After my dad really got help for those things, our family dynamic changed a lot and my upbringing changed a lot.
When you say a lot, was that something that you, just by hearing from your brothers and sisters or whoever else, did you feel like a sense that there was this volatility when before you were born, that there was sort of like an imbalance and, you know, a lot of feuding in the family?
More than anything, it was that my dad was physically not very present. So he would work like, I mean, you know, when I was a very young kid, my dad would work like 100, 120, 140 hours a week. You know what I mean? Like, he was just not.
Did he love it?
There.
Was he a workaholic?
Way workaholic.
Obviously.
And
right.
Jimmy has that too. Jimmy's inherited that from him.
Yeah.
But he was very, he would work all the time. And, you know, you can go back and sort of psychoanalyze that from different perspectives. I mean, was it really just loving his job that much? Was he not wanting to go home as much? Was he like, who knows? But my memory of my dad when I was super young is that he would come home from work, usually fairly late. And that when he came home, everything in the house, it was time for it to sort of like stop and be quiet. And like it's like the boisterous part of the day with all of, you know, like, there's eight people living in this house. And so
the others were around still when you were there.
Yeah. And then they started to go to college and then I got a little, you know, older. And I think, I guess when I was around 10 is when my dad kind of like got help and started to, it makes sense. It was the,
why did he get help?
Because of my brothers, because
they pestered him. They sort of like,
well, no, I think he just saw, he was invested in it. I mean, he really did love his family and his kids. And my brother James quit drinking and started to, it became introspective. You go into treatment, you get sober, you look inside, you start to like, do, you know, and it was the early 80s, you know, early mid 80s. It was like, it started to become fashionable to really look at yourself and to see. And I think my dad wanted to support my brother. And then my next brother also like got sober. And I think
was that Patrick?
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the process of my dad wanting to support them and seeing what it was they were going through, he did it himself. And he started to say, oh, I have all these patterns of behavior that were not good for my life. And from that point on, my parents changed so much, you know, around the time that I was like 10, 11, 12 years old. So my oldest brothers at that point, when I was 10, 11, 12, they were 16, 18, 20. So for them, it was already, they were in early adulthood. But for me, I was still a kid.
Right.
But that's the house that I grew up in. I don't really know.
The house that Jim built.
Yeah.
The house that Big Jim built.
Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I don't know how many times I have to talk about this, but it's so important. If you're sitting there right now and you're stressed or you're anxious or you have a lot on your mind and you just bottle it up and you don't know what to do, it's going to come out, and it's not going to come out in great ways all the time. BetterHelp has helped me substantially. Ryan here has been using it for a while. And I, you know, don't you notice when you don't use BetterHelp? When you don't have therapy?
Oh, the weeks where I miss a session? Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, the more you talk about something, even if you don't think you have anything to talk about, things come up and it puts your mind at ease. And we all carry around different stressors, you know, big and small. And at times we keep carrying them around rather than processing them and letting them go. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively.
Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
Therapy from BetterHelp is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It's for all of us. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I think people think, oh, what if I don't like my therapist? If you don't, you switch them. It's that easy. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/inside today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/inside.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories, and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Were they always loving parents? Because now, you know, I see them and I see this side that, you know, he's just such a calm, lovable, you know, he calls me Rosie. He's like, Rosie, how are you?
He's,
you know,
great.
Still texting. And just like this soft spoken man. And so when I hear stories about, like, you know, he was a big drinker and he could get a little physical or he could get whatever. And he's just this guy. He's like, hey, fuck, I made mistakes. And now I've got this new life. And was he one of those fathers where he said, I'm proud of you, Sean. I love you, son. You always felt that.
Constantly, you know, and as you know, my dad's he's getting older and his health is failing him now. And so you're kind of looking back over a life. And my brother Matt said to me, it's sad that we're seeing our father sort of reach the end of his life, but look at all these great things, first of all, that he accomplished. Look at this great family that he helped sort of raise and teach. And Matt said, have you ever wondered whether you were loved, or whether, you know, have you ever questioned whether our parents were proud of you or loved you? And the answer is no. They told us constantly. And I grew up being told that, like, hey, anything you want to do with your life, we support you, and you can go ahead and do that. Whatever it is you want to do, like, we'll do that. My parents told me that always. And I grew up thinking that that's what parents say to kids. Like, I just thought that that's, well, let's say, like, that's what you're.
No, I know.
And it wasn't really until I got to college where I realized how many people had parents that, like, discouraged them from doing the things that they wanted to do.
Or weren't that influential supportive, or just didn't
care or checked out you know, all those things. And, like, I don't want to say that I came from this model family. I didn't. My parents certainly had their ways in which there was a lot of things about my family that weren't perfect. And in some ways I feel more raised by my older siblings than I do by my parents, but you know, I have great older siblings, so that kind of works out too.
Yeah,
you know,
it's so weird. I became the believe it or not, like I was the one like right in the middle sort of. I remember my older brother calling me like at 2 a.m. He has anxiety attacks and I'm sort of walking him through it as this drunk 19-year-old kid in college. And, you know, my mom telling me she's going to kill herself after my parents got divorced. And I'm like, Mom, I just got my first TV show and I got to be in work in the morning and please don't kill yourself. And, you know, my sister, just I'm always their therapist until one day. Some of the best advice I ever got were my therapist, therapist from a few years back. I always say you get a little bit from everybody, even if they're not whatever you wanted, you get something. And he said, you know, because I'd say, you know, my mom's crazy. This. He goes, you know, what's crazier is you thinking you could make them different or change them and make them the sister or mother, whatever it is that you want, or you trying to fix them. That's crazy. That's fantasy. That can't happen. So you're wasting your time by doing this, and you're enabling and your energy for yourself, that you're not giving yourself all this energy. It's exhausting. And that's all you do is help. I did this Enneagram, it's called. I didn't know what a fucking Enneagram is. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I did. But this one therapist said, take an Enneagram. Just take it. And I go, what is it? Just take it. It's 20 minutes. I'll send you the quiz. And it tells you your personality traits. It tells you, you know, what you are. And of course, I was number one helper, number two loyalist, number three enthusiast. which of course, look at me, full of enthusiasm.
Yeah, right. To me, I have a weird relationship with it because on one hand, I did have this great, I'm incredibly privileged in so many ways. I had this great family, you know, I'm a straight white male. You get all the things that go along with that.
Yeah.
And like, and so I'm incredibly privileged, but I had a lot of health problems, which I never, you know, would made me feel like an outsider.
What health problems?
I've had a lot of health problems in my life growing up.
From childhood was the big ones.
Childhoods, I had several major surgeries in the first several years of my life. I have a lung condition called restrictive airway disease, which is in the family of having asthma, but it's not. It's something a little different. And I was born with a pectus, so I had this like hole in my chest, which doctors for the first 10, 12 years of my life and then beyond that thought they weren't sure if my body was going to be able to develop. They thought that my chest might actually collapse in on itself as I got older. So
this is what your parents were hearing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so I went to doctors constantly. I would go like once a week.
Did you hate it?
No. I grew up with it. So that like I go back to the, I had to go to the hospital a couple months ago, but I'll go into a hospital now and that smell, you know, that distinctive smell of a hospital, it's very comforting to me. It's
really?
Which is like totally the opposite of almost everyone else I've ever known.
I understand it. I get it because it's like for us, I mean, look, I've had a lot of surgeries too, spine surgeries and everything. And mm-hmm. There's a comfort to it knowing that, hey, there's people here who are going to help you. And I mean, did they think you're going to die at a young age? Did you have any scares where like, hey, Sean might not make
it? Well, I had a major surgery when I was like 4 where I had major reconstructive chest surgery. And so that was certainly a life-threatening surgery. And then I had a board strapped to my back that likes to keep my chest upright as a kid, which made me sort of this little weirdo. I was incredibly skinny. I was like, you know, my brother still likes to tell the story in interviews of how I used to go through a wire coat hanger, just a regular wire hanger. I would put my whole body through it without bending it. And that was like until I was like 12, like pretty.
Did you hate it?
Old. I loved it because I was a performer. And so I hate it now. I hate it now when interviewers bring it up and they're like, hey, somebody said you had this great trick you can do. I'm like, yeah, when I was a child, you know, but I was like this mascot, you know, where my siblings would trot me out and have me do these tricks for their friends and things like that.
And if it was James, I'm sure, Jimmy, it was mean.
Yeah, it was always kind of half mean, you know.
Of course.
But I was a performer. I told jokes. I would like to get and I had then what I still have now, which is that when I perform in front of people, I feel alive in a way that like nothing else really gives me. I mean,
you don't get nervous?
I do get nervous. I do. But
that
there's an excitement to it.
That feeling when you must know it. I mean, you're a performer, so that feeling when you're like in the zone.
Yeah, you're an ex-performer. You should know about
that. I'm an ex-performer.
Yeah, you used to be an actor.
Yeah, I was an actor once.
Oh God, no, but I, you know, that feeling when you're kind of like everyone's watching and you know you have them. Mm-hmm. Like it can happen on stage. It can happen like I hosted an awards ceremony and it happens there, or you go into an audition that's like filled with a room of people and you know when you've got them, like you can, you can feel it.
That's,
you know,
a special
what I mean?
Feeling, yeah.
And like, what feels better than that? I still that's the dragon I chase.
You crave it
today.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just always wanted to perform. It's one of the reasons why I get some inspiration by listening to your podcast, because I like listening to these people that have had all sorts of different careers that have taken left turns and right turns and where it goes in a direction they don't know where it's going to go, because I still have, you know, like whatever. I had an audition yesterday that I want so bad and I don't think I'm going to get it. It's killing me. It's killing me today, you know, and I still have it all the time.
So you know what? That's one thing, as much anxiety as I have and all the other shit, I have always been really good about not getting something. To me, it's almost a relief. I don't have to put so much into it. And, you know, my work ethic has to change. And I think if it did, I think from a young age, I just worked to the point where it's like, you take a break from this. You don't have to work all day on a part every day. You could spend 2 or 3 hours and then go have another life. Mm-hmm. And I worked so hard that I think it affected me, and I know what my work ethic is, and I've had so much success that it's hard to change at this point because that's how I do it. When I have that relief sort of after an audition where I leave and I just rip the pages up and I throw them in the trash before I leave and you know, what I don't like is people, hey, you know, I don't tell my mother about auditions. I stopped doing that, and I think 99 or two, maybe 2000.
Sure.
Because it was like, did you get it?
Mom, no, I know.
Saving Private Ryan is already in theaters. I did not get the fucking part, which I did audition. And there's sometimes I'm very good at watching something going, God, you could never have done that. This guy killed it. Ed Norton in that Primal Fear. God, he killed it. I was very, very close to getting that.
Oh, God.
Back in the day. And I go, I couldn't have done that. He's extraordinary. But then there's some stuff I watch and I go, I could do that.
You could have done that, bro. You could have done it.
I wouldn't have done it that way. But listen, what I'm saying is
that's not what
he was so genius that I don't think I would have made that kind of choice. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying, like, believe it or not, like, I'll watch some things and it sounds cocky, but I'll go, well, that, he's genius and he's great and he deserves every award in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I could have done that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I will say that, or I'm confident about things, but I'm also like realistic and you know, I don't have to have everything, but like,
I've been doing it long enough to know that like, that's the way the job works, is you go in on an audition and that's your job is to audition. And once it's done, it's done, you know? And like, that's like you said, you rip up the sides when you're walking out. Like, that's the mindset you need to have. Like, that's the athlete's mindset. Actually doing that in practice is tricky in different ways.
Sure.
leaving it
on the field.
And so
it's not
like,
that easy.
I'm pretty good at leaving most of them on the field. There are those ones that get under your skin, you know, those ones that are like,
what are the ones? Without saying the last one, because you probably can't say the last one.
I can't say the last one. Who knows? Maybe they'll still call, although it's TV. So usually get a call the next day on TV. You know, movies can be weeks before you hear anything.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know. It's true.
Urban legend was, I remember bumping into some girl and she goes, are you Michael Rosenbaum? And I'm like, yeah. She goes, my name is Tara. I'm sorry, Tara Reid doesn't talk like that.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm Tara Reid. And I'm like, oh hey, I don't know you. I didn't know anybody. And she goes, you're going to play my boyfriend in Urban Legend. And I go, that's funny. I auditioned for that like a month ago. She goes, no, you're the guy. They already told my agent that you're the guy. I'm like, why am I finding this out from you?
Oh, God.
So then I call my agent the next day. Oh, we haven't heard anything.
Yeah, right.
And of course, about a week later, I get a call saying, hey, man, you booked the job.
Well, there you go. You got it.
So that it does happen, but it is rare. They like
you
to
were,
move
if
fast.
I'm, unless I'm mistaken, you were with Tara Reid when I met you. Yeah, I don't think you would ever remember this. It was
probably
many, many years ago. And if I'm not wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you at a rap party for the movie I think it was the movie Basketball. It was one of those Trey Parker Matt Stone. Was it at the Playboy Mansion?
Yes. I was.
And I met you
Motley
there.
Crue, or who played there? Wasn't it like Metallica or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, Metallica played a private concert.
And I
was
there. My brother Patrick was involved in the production of that movie somehow, or distribution, I guess. And
was it nice?
And I was there, and I was there with Jamie Kennedy, and you knew Jamie, and Jamie was a friend of mine,
right?
And he introduced. No. It was literally like hey, dude, hey, man, nice to meet you.
Cool, bro.
Yeah, whatever.
All right.
And I and that was when I met you, but I didn't really meet you until years later. But anyway, where was I going with that? So you leave it on the field, you leave auditions on the field, but I also am not. I feel like I keep almost leveling up in my career.
You are obviously leveling up.
Then I do when I'm not looking for it, and then I don't again when
Doesn't
I think
that
I'm
always
going
happens
to.
Happens like
you
that,
know what
right?
I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And like things were going for me as well as they could have ever been going, having had the revival of Gilmore Girls come out and be a huge success, and having Guardians 2 come out and be a huge success, and to have like an arc in that movie, and to have a substantial role, and to have a lot of press from that, and have been doing the Rocket stuff, which I didn't get as much, you know, acclaim for, but then more people knew about, and so I'm like, hey man, I'm like right here, I'm ready for things to go,
and then you go down a bit.
Then I went and I did the biggest movie of all time, Infinity War and Endgame as Rocket, you know, but it's not my face. It's not my voice. I spend a year doing that, and then I can't get a job after I'm done doing that. So like, it's like this weird, I have these weird ebbs and flows.
Yeah. And you know, obviously that's the career. It's just like, you know, that's the career we chose, and you love it and you hate it. Mm-hmm. But you know, I look at your career and we met, what, they're called Sunset Sundays?
Is that how
we
met? Was my house.
Your house, you used to have Sunset Sundays, and James would invite me over, and I'd go to your place, mm-hmm. and that's where we met. You have cheese and wine and all of this stuff, and that's where I met all that, the Motley crew of people, and the Yarvos and the Steve Agees, who, you know, and everybody ended up working on Guardians and a lot mm-hmm. of James's projects. And, you know, we always got along. We always, like, we hit it off. And I always liked you. And then fast forward to, I just went to your wedding.
Yeah.
You know, and you married Natasha. And you just, it was about a month ago, it was in Catalina.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody was there. And it was just it was a fantastic wedding. It really was. It was
thanks.
Just the little picnic area.
It was so beautiful. It meant a lot to me that you made it, because I knew you had been having
surgery.
Some surgery.
But
I
didn't want to miss it. I was like, I'm getting my ass out there. But everything, it's like you look at, you know, and I just love seeing it. Because I remember you did Gilmore Girls. And I remember there was a lull there for a while where you were like, fuck, dude, I need to work.
Yeah.
I need to pay my rent. And it's tough. And it's just like one day you have a series for 7 years.
Sure.
And then the next thing you know, you're like, I can't find a job.
I lost my house. I mean, I like to be upfront about that and not be sort of embarrassed by, I think it's important to not be embarrassed by things like that. Yeah. I had that house that was up on the hill in Silver Lake, and it was just kind of a perfect storm of, you know, it was like a little over my head.
Didn't the relationship
end
too?
There was a relationship that ended, but it was mostly just like the series ended. Work got slow in a way that it never had been in my whole career. So like I had always booked at a really good rate, you know, until after Gilmore Girls ended, which is like, and then all of a sudden I wasn't working that much. And then the housing market collapsed, you know, so like everything, all that, the whole financial crisis.
Was that your lowest time?
Yes. Yes.
Did you feel like I'm depressed? I had anxiety.
Big time.
Mm-hmm. What did you do about it?
I don't know.
I saw Dr. Lowe?
I think I moved on. You know, I just kind of pressed forward. I did go to therapy, but not till a little bit later. Like I didn't write during the worst part of things, but I was pretty low. And I was like, what am I going to do? I'd never had I made my living as an actor from the day I moved to LA. Like I never had a day job in LA. I had made just enough money doing commercials in Chicago when I moved to LA to be able to kind of ride my first 6-8 months of not working until I started booking jobs and started working. And so I'd been supporting myself as an actor often just barely, but been supporting myself doing that for, you know,
15 years, 20 years.
Yeah, well, yeah, till like 2012. So like 15 years, close to 15 years, and then all of a sudden, like, I was out of money and I lost my house, and I'm like, what am I going
to
do?
Were you thinking of getting a real job?
I had to.
I'm going to have to get a real job.
I had to. Dude, the day, well, I was going to start teaching because it was the one thing that I'm like, I'm qualified to do this. I don't love doing it, but I can do it. And I had done some acting. I had done some coaching for friends and had good success. Like, they had booked roles when I had coached them for auditions and stuff. And I had taught some a little bit, like some workshops and stuff. And I was like, I guess I'm going to do this. And I wrote up a plan to do it. And I was going to post this thing where I was going to do some acting workshops. And like, my brother called me and said, hey, I want you to come do Guardians for 6 months in London. Like, right then, like the day that I was going to post those things on Facebook saying that I was going to do these acting workshops. And it was devastating to me. Like, I never had a big ego about being like hugely successful or hugely famous, but I always had a pretty big ego about being good and being hireable. And being an actor is my profession. It's not my dream. You know, like, to me, the word dream is associated with something that's not real. And so I was always like, no, it's not. This is not a dream. It's my profession. It's what I do for a living.
I am not my work. Ray Nelson said that.
I always felt like very connected to the fact that, like, I wasn't worried about my career collapsing, and then it did.
Yeah. Not that we have to go into it, but I kind of want to go into it because I look at these pictures and I look at the videos and I see you on set and I see you as Rocket. It's equivalent to like Andy Serkis in Lord of the Rings, correct?
Kind of.
As Gollum, in a way.
Here's where it's different. I need to point out where it's different.
Okay.
First of all, the process is different because Andy Serkis actually has all the like digital balls on his face and stuff. So there's actual motion capture. So the performance is digitally altered through an algorithm where they take somebody's performance and turn it into another one digitally. I don't do that because Rocket is too different from a human.
He's the size up to your like mid shin.
Right. And also his face has like a snout. It's not a humanoid face.
It's a small face.
So when they do it digitally, it looks stupid. So what they are doing is they're actually looking at what I'm doing and then manipulating it. The animators are like animating what I'm doing, but they can change it. They can tweak it. Also, I'm not playing the role. I mean, Bradley Cooper comes in later and does the voice of the character, and he completes the performance.
Right.
It's like there's several people involved first, and then he's involved. And then
there's three steps. There's you doing it. Then it's sort of like animated or whatever.
Yes.
And then the voice.
Right. And then it's animated again. So it's almost like there's almost like an animation draft, and then he completes it. And then the animator's like really complete.
When they asked you, James said, hey, you're going to play Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, how did he know that you would want to play Rocket? Like playing this crawling around, like physically, I mean, that's...
Well, we didn't know. First of all, he knew I would want the job because, as I said, I was broke.
Yeah, of course.
But we didn't know what that was going to look like. He just knew that he wanted a real actor to do it on set so that the other actors weren't talking to a blank space or a tennis ball on a stick or, you know, a PA holding a binder in their hands.
So you're saying all the lines and everything.
So he's like, so I want you to come do it. He's like, at the very least, I want you to read it for the read through. We're going to figure out what we're, and there was some ridiculous, I mean, like there was this thought that maybe, you know, we had a little person that was going to walk around as Rocket with a speaker like hanging from her neck with my voice coming out of it. And it was the most bizarre and awful thing. You know, we did the first rehearsal and we were like, okay, let's get this thing up on its feet. And I was like, I'm just going to get down and start doing it. And I have I'm very limber and I have a weird sort of body type and incredibly open hips. And so I was able to kind of crouch down and start doing the role. And it was like, this is what works. And so that's what we did.
how demanding is it? Honestly, I mean, you can't tell me that you're not physically, like, for me, I look at it and I'm like, my knees would kill, my back, my neck.
It's demanding. Everybody always thinks it's my knees, but for whatever reason, my knees are fine. It's my ankles and my feet that hurt really bad at the end of the day.
Do you have in your contract that you have to have, like, massage therapists?
I was going to try to put it in there for three, honestly, but I haven't yet. It's funny because I'm starting to get too old to do it, you know, and like, one of the many, many bummers about my brother getting fired from Guardians 3 was that it postponed for like 2 years, you know, or however many years. I wanted to play Rocket in the third movie and then put it to bed and not do it anymore because I'm getting too old to do it. And then after it was like, oh, well, now we're postponing the movie for another however long we postpone it. It's like, damn it, I'm going to have to do it when I'm even older than I am. But I have to finish it. I mean, I have to finish the, you know.
The first one. Mm-hmm. To play Rocket, to play Kraglin at the same time. Kraglin wasn't as big of a role as the one in the second one, obviously.
Right.
Was the pay shit?
Yeah, for the first movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, were you like, I am getting $5,000 a week?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of exactly what it was, but it wasn't good. I mean, I got paid scale for Kraglin, but it was, you know, it was a few weeks of work, and I got, should I just say, I mean, should
sure,
I, like,
it's the first,
you know,
one.
I got like a Schedule F contract for a Rocket, so I was paid a lump sum for the full course of the thing.
But you probably worked. Now, you're probably working 14 hours a day for 5 days a week, right?
Well, not exactly 5 days a week. I mean, Rocket's role is not quite that big in the first movie, but I worked a ton. And I know on the second movie, I mean, that was a little different and the pay was better, obviously. But on the second movie, I had the most number of days on set.
How many were
there? Anybody. How many days on set?
Yeah.
I think like, you know, mid-50s or something.
Does that scare you? Like, oh, fuck, can I do that?
No, I loved it. That's what I want all the time.
You just want to be on set.
I wish I was going tomorrow to do that.
You just want
to
be on set.
I really do. Well, I just want to be employed. You know, like, I like my days off.
I love it. It's so nice.
I like my days off when I'm working, yeah. You know. But
sure.
I've always loved acting. And I feel like now I try to make a point to love it more than ever because it's so much harder in some ways. You know, you said before that you hate it and you love it, you know, and I think that that's true. And because of the reasons that I hate it, I try to make my loving it that much more, love it
profoundly
that much
more,
yeah. When I love it. And like, I, you know, my wife, she's said, you know, you'd work every day if you could.
Yeah, you get that gun gene that you just want to work all the time.
Well, the weird, you know, the weird flip side of that is that I've worked so little. I mean, I've worked a lot on the Guardians movies and stuff, but like, my God, I was on Gilmore Girls for 7 years from like 2000 to 2007. And I had buddies that were like, dude, you have the sweetest gig in Hollywood.
You work 2 days a week.
Because I would work,
it's great.
You know, we would do eight days per episode. Mm-hmm. Is that what you guys did?
We did 10 because they did two for special effects or like
stunts.
Oh,
right. Okay. Right. Yeah.
So
visual effects. Yeah. So we shot 8 days per episode, long hours on that show, but my character was like comic relief and I would work, you know, 1 or 2 days an episode. Maybe if I had it, maybe it was a big episode for me, I'd work 4 days, but
were they pains in the asses?
Who?
Lauren.
Let me say this about
because she's, by the way, fantastic.
What people will write about.
She's a fantastic.
She's
actress.
A lovely person.
She is a lovely person. I've met her. She's awesome in person. She's a fantastic actress. She's enormously talented. But I just wonder, like, God, if I had to learn those lines, that meant that much stuff. I wonder if it just drove her crazy.
There were just reams and reams and reams of dialogue every episode. You know, a minute a page is sort of the rule. We had a 42-minute show. And we averaged, I think, 82 page scripts. So we were, that's how much dialogue.
She's learning a movie in a week.
We were doing over 10 pages every, we averaged over 10 pages every single
day. I would have collapsed. I'm not even joking
for the whole series.
I would have died.
And it's reams and reams of dialogue. And we had to be verbatim or we'd do it again.
And who's the creator? Friend of
Amy Sherman Palladino.
Right. She's
a genius.
I sat next to her at the wedding. I didn't know who she was. She was at your wedding.
Yes.
And we started talking and laughing and goofing and like, being corny and talking shit. And the next thing I know, I'm like, Oh, wait a minute. You're the creator of the Gilmore Girls and the Marvelous.
And Marvelous Ms. Maisel. She's
fuck
amazing.
You. You're a genius.
She's amazing. Like, well, and so is her husband.
Yeah. Oh my God, husband. I yeah. love them.
Yeah, they're great. And at the time, they were scary to me when I was hired and when I was on the show. It was like, she was my boss. So she was the, you know, the top of the show. Sure. And I look back now, you know, that was 20 years ago. And I look back and I was like, she was like in her mid 30s and was a female showrunner in a male dominated
world. How impossible is that?
World.
Yeah.
And putting her foot down and saying, no, I really want the show to be the way that I want it to be. And I think there was a lot of times and she's like, I'm really not all that interested in your notes, you know, to the,
dude, I love
to
that.
Like, and she's a yeah. fucking genius.
She's
and
a
I'm
genius
so,
and, yeah.
so lucky to have worked with her and with Dan as much as I did. And I understood why it had to be verbatim. That's not complaining. I'm not saying like, oh, it had to be verbatim. Can you believe that? It's like, no, it was this old school kind of film comedy style. It's why I got cast to begin with. I read the script and I'm like, oh, this is like the front page and Bringing Up Baby and these old Howard Hawks scripts. Like, I was a student of film. And so I knew that, like, this is the style of the show.
You said that to her?
No, I just knew it.
You just knew the style.
I just knew it and I performed it like right. that. And she responded to it.
Ah.
I don't think I've told her that to this day, but I'm sure she knows.
Back
that. I know.
To Lauren Graham.
Back to Lauren Graham. So the point is this. They were worked, she and Alexis, particularly Lauren, but Lauren and Alexis were worked so ridiculously hard that I think that it made them a little bit nuts. And I would imagine she would say the same thing if she was here, that like it got to a point where like that show just started to crush the leads. For me, it was great. I had my one or two days. Like, yeah, I would have long days, but there weren't that many of them. And so it was like awesome. So when I've heard she's difficult to work with, it's like, no. You know, like she's wonderful to work with.
Yeah.
She's a great person. And you have to understand all these things within their context. Was she totally sunshine all the time? Like,
who is?
Definitely not.
No, I don't know anybody who's always sunshine right. or they're on Molly's.
Right. Yeah. John Lithgow, maybe. But,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly. All right. So that's fair. I totally get that.
Yeah. I like all of the people that I worked with very much. It was not an easy set to work on.
Yeah, it just was tense.
It was just difficult. It was long. There were very long hours, and people get frustrated. And crew,
even crew guys,
especially
Did you
crew
ever
guys.
See crew guys go, ah, fuck it. I don't know.
Every day.
Isn't that hard? When people are
every day,
there's nothing like just having fun and everybody's energy. It's just, but when it turns a little sour because people are working so hard, like I look at those Game of Thrones shows, and I'm like, oh my God, they're probably dying shooting this. Mm-hmm. It's probably their last day of life.
Yeah.
They're going to die the next day.
Yeah.
So I get a crew. There's nobody. They say that the average, you know, I don't know if it's TV director or TV producers, they live like in their 50s. They're just, their heart gives out. They're exhausted. There's like crazy shit. All right. I want to talk to you about this. You know, I love Jimmy. He's one of my best friends. Is it hard to work for your brother? He's an amazing individual. I love him. His heart is, it's gold. And he's a genius and all that. And we talked, he's alpha. We both know that and we love it. And I am too. And, you know, look, when I worked with him, I worked with him for a couple of days in Guardians. So, you know, but I'm sure those moments get really tense and they're like, you know, and he wants things done a certain way. Are there any times where as a brother, you forget, like, you're like, hey, I'm just going to, you know, he's like, Sean, no, I need you to.
Yeah. It doesn't last very long. My brother is really good at his job, so that makes it not hard, you know, to work together. And our jobs fit together very well. He's a creator and he's a writer director, and I'm an actor, and we have a shorthand for communicating with one another that is good or better than he has with any other actor, I would think. I love working with my brother. It's easier being on set with him than it is with just about anyone else. There are times when he gets a little testy with me, but for the most part, he's kind of his best self when he's on set directing. And he's such a maniac for pre-production and for preparation. So much of the work is already done when we're on set that we actually, as actors, have the ability to really play with the scenes and figure out what the scenes are about and have that be the focus of the day rather than all the other shit that people can be obsessed with while they're trying to shoot a movie. He does a good job of creating that cocoon for the actors so that we're really just sort of working on the scenes. And so at the end of the day, it's like, I get that question all the time. What's it like working with your brother? And the truth is it's better than it is working with just about anyone else. Like, that's the one thing from now until the end of my career. If he calls and says, I need you to do this for me, I do it. Because
that's awesome. I love that.
You know, because, yeah, I mean, that's the sort of the contract that we have with,
yeah,
with one another. But, you know, you've worked with him on set. He's really,
he's really low key.
He's more high strung in other, like, I'd imagine
in that, a real life.
I imagine that if there are people that get the full brunt of his bad side that he works with, it's people that aren't living up to his high standards in the earlier part of the process. You know, I bet he yells more in the production office, right, than he does on set. But I think people, for the most part, like working with him. I mean,
yeah, I haven't heard one thing that, you know, person that doesn't. And I think that it's like, I mean, look at the great directors like Kubrick, and, you know, there's a certain level, like you said, of, you know, preparation. And, you know, if you watch these old videos with Shelley Long, he's like, Shelley, what are you doing?
Oh, God.
We said action. Did you ever see that? The documentary for The Shining?
I think you mean Shelley Duvall.
Shelley Duvall.
Would it be pretty funny if that was Shelley Long in The Shining? No, I haven't seen that documentary, but I've heard, I've read about that.
It's incredible.
That he tormented her and, like, you know, and that doesn't sound very nice.
Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when this whole thing happened with James, when he got fired off of Guardians, mm-hmm, and thank God he got, you know, reinstated or whatever, sure, and he's back. And what went through your head? Like, it's got to be just tough as a brother. It's like you always have your brother's back.
Yeah. That was a very strange experience for me. And there's a part of me that wished that I, like, kept a journal through that, you know, because those days, particularly right in the, like, the 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks following his getting fired were very strange, because I was in a unique position. I'm both his brother and somebody who, you know, supports him down the line. And I could go one direction and be like, let me try to actually support my brother and tell you why what he did either wasn't that bad at all, or at least probably wasn't as bad as you think it was in terms of the tweets from years earlier that he got fired for. But then I'm also a member of the cast. So at that same time, the cast is, you know, I'm communicating with my colleagues and with Chris and Zoe and Dave and Pom and Karen and Rooker primarily. And the public statement that we made, that we all signed, we really collaborated on that. And so I'm kind of like riding this fence where I'm supporting my brother, but I'm also wanting to, as a cast member, do exactly the right thing in terms of putting on the public face. And I wanted to write my own statement that supported my brother, but that also put it in some context without flying off the handle. I mean, my gut instinct was to be furious. And I wish I could have, in many ways, been as upset as, say, Bautista was about it. You know,
he was pretty
Bautista
vocal.
was
livid,
outraged. Still is in many ways. And God, I love him for it. And I wanted to kind of be right there with him. First of all, I don't quite have the career where I can do that, because I don't have, if all of a sudden I become known as somebody who's difficult in some way, I'm not there yet. You know, like, I can't, like, I remember Bautista saying to me, you know, fuck him. If I get blackballed, I'll go wrestle in Japan. And it's like, I can't go wrestle in Japan. Maybe I could, I don't know. We'll see after. But also, I didn't pack the same punch as other people did in terms of defending my brother. So any defense I gave, I knew that people would say, well, yeah, you're his brother, so you have to say that. So I knew that what I said had to be smart enough that people really took it at least a little bit separate from the fact that I was his brother. So it was really like this time when I'm like, oh my God, I want to
fire back.
I never felt so much pressure to say exactly the right thing as I did in those days following his getting fired. And I was hopeful that it would, like, I don't know if blowing over is exactly the right term for what happened, but I think that what has happened since in terms of him getting rehired has been appropriate. And, from this point on, it's like, I'm happy to talk about it if people want to talk about it, but I love not having to talk about it too. You know,
so we won't talk about
it. No,
that.
No, no, you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, it's like I'm, but like I'm an actor. I don't want my name in the paper for anything other than giving a great acting performance.
How many times did you look at what you had written? Because you did write something. Mm-hmm. How long before you actually sent it? Because with us, I think we're fiery. If I see something, I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. Mm-hmm. Take a deep breath. You're not mm-hmm. sending anything until you really, really think about this. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to do, especially when you're coming from a place of just, it's like in your heart, it's in your stomach, it's everywhere. And it's just like, I want to defend my brother. Right. Or whatever. How long did it take before you said, okay, this is, how many times did you look at it and pre-sent it?
I remember that it was that he was fired on a Friday, and it was right when my then fiance and now wife and I had started to take a road trip to St. Louis to see my parents. And we got in super late at night, and I could barely sleep. And I woke up and I wrote my statement at like 6 a.m. It took me about an hour or so to actually write it. And then about 5 or 6 hours of rereading and rereading. And Natasha was incredibly helpful in not only helping me edit it and say, I think you should take this out and I think you should say this, but also in sort of steering me in the right direction and saying, you know, just keep in mind as you're writing this statement to come from a place of like love and generosity of spirit. I know that you're angry, but having your anger come out in this statement is not going to be helpful for James. It's not going to be helpful for you personally. So like, keep your eye on what's important as you write this. And like, she was really helpful. But yeah, I just read it over and over and over and over again.
Sure.
And I gave it to my brother Brian to say, you know, because they're like, is there anything in here that, because at that time, there's this fear that like, I'm going to put out a statement and I'll say one wrong thing in there. And then all of a sudden, I got 100 people on me.
All of a sudden, Marvel's like, oh yeah, well now his brother's fired.
Right.
Oh yeah, now his other brother's fired.
Right. Yeah,
his whole family.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, you know, we'll wind this down. You know, I went to the wedding. It was beautiful. And I noticed you had your parents were there live, like a FaceTime or something. Yeah. And they were kind of watching this because your dad's been sick and he's in St. Louis. And I know that was hard on you. I know it was hard on the entire family. Mm-hmm. And we've had conversations about this. And, you know, obviously it makes me sad. I can't imagine how you guys feel. But, you know, it had to be tough making a decision like, hey, should we cancel the wedding? Should we, you know, what is there to wait for? And mm-hmm. It's like your dad's sick. You could stop everything and, you know, he doesn't want that. But it was just like, when are you going to prepare for what you can't prepare for?
Yes. We couldn't anticipate what was going to happen. And so there were times when we were trying to schedule the wedding around when my dad might be able to be there, or what we thought of his health situation at the time. And then you get to a point where it's just like, you just have to continue and know that he supports us. And I actually think in some ways that my dad loves my wife and is so happy that we met each other. And I think that the fact that we were getting married was always more important to him than obviously he would have loved to be there, but the event itself to him, I think, was probably even more important than his involvement with it.
I also think, you know, the way I look at it is he did see you and he knows that his son was married to this woman who he loved.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows how happy you are and he knows how proud of you he is. And it's hard because I know what a close relationship you have. And, you know, it's weird because my father and I are finally, there's sort of an understanding, you know, he knows I went to this facility, you know, and I just said, hey, I'm going to this place. And, you know, there's been a certain turning over a new leaf with my father where he's just, you know, he's been saying things that are more, wow, I'm talking to someone who's a human being. I'm talking to I'm feeling, you know, empathy. I'm getting empathy. I'm getting more of an understanding than I ever did as a child. And, you know, I went through a lot to realize that, hey, they did the best they could. And, you know, I forgive my parents and I love them. And it's just nice to think that, you know, we're in a different place. Because I'd say I envy you and, you know, especially over the years, you and Jimmy and the rest of your family and a lot of my friends' families, I always sort of envied. I was always I always had surrogate parents in a way. I felt like, oh, you know, your dad texts me and he's like, Rosie. And I just like, gosh, you know, and I want that. I want that.
Yeah.
And I feel sad.
I can tell you that I feel like my father and I have an understanding of one another. I was always, of all my siblings, the one who was kind of the least invested in approval and in needing my mom and dad to like approve of the life that I was living or think that I was doing the right things. That was never super important to me. I was always like, I'm going to do my own thing. And I just sort of know that. But I also know that my dad really respects that about me. And to me, there was something really important in not searching for anything specific from my dad that gave me the most amount possible that I could actually get from him. Is that a weird thing to say? Like I only just wanted him to kind of understand me, and he's done that. And I think I understand him better.
I think you're articulating it better than I am, because that's what I'm trying to say is like, I'm the opposite. I'm like, in a way, you know, I've been trying like, you know, success and this and that, like to make him sort of understand me, to love me, to, you know, I've heard it from a lot of people. And so what you're saying is sort of the opposite, where you don't need that, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's ultimately what I was trying to say. And what you're trying to say is that there's something really cool about knowing that you both get each other and you both love each other and you appreciate each other and respect each other. And I think that's what I'm, you know, striving to hopefully get to a place. And I certainly look at effort in a different way now. I think that effort is, you know, when someone says, you know, my dad said something to me while we were driving up to the mountains like 2 weeks ago, he's just said, is after I talked about a little bit about, you know, what I went through, but I didn't get too deep with my dad. I don't, you know, I just still very, there's a wall there. And he said, you know, I'll never forget. I was working for this company and he was so stressed out. And he just was like, you know, he was so depressed. And he's just like, I thought, you know, being dead would probably be better. And it was the first time, like, he just opened up a little to me. Mm-hmm. Like, he was like, and he was staring at the road as he's driving. And I go, I get it, Dad. I get it. And there was that, just that moment where I felt like, this is kind of like, cool. This is like, there's a connection for just a moment. And so it's cool.
Yeah. Once you kind of put yourself in the mindset of like, yeah, there are things I need from this person, but not really.
Yeah.
There's nothing I really actually need other than to be able to sit and experience the pleasure of their company and try and the effort to try to understand one another is the understanding.
Well, where can we find you on the, after such an intense conversation? Look, yeah, man, listen, I want to say thank you for coming. And this is, you know, you're so open. And, you know, I was like, you know, should I talk to him about the Guardians thing? Should I talk to him about, you know, I know your dad's sick, but you were pretty forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And it just, it made for just really good understanding and conversation and just like a respect. And I think that you being open and not, you know, you telling me about your, you know, you had to sell your house and you were down and out. I mean, I think that's what people sort of like, it makes you just more human. It makes you like relatable, you know? And I think when people listen, whether you're an actor or not, it's like people hit certain places and they're embarrassed by things that happen along the way, failures. And as we all know, failures make you stronger. They just do.
Yeah.
They just do unless you let them.
100%. And I meant it when I said to you, that's what I like about this podcast is that I think that I've heard a lot of people come in here and they sort of lose the artifice of whatever it is that they're, you know, I've heard people talk about real shit. And so like, it's more interesting that way anyway, right?
I agree. Sean Gunn, you got Guardians 3. You're gonna end up doing that again.
Yeah, I got I got something pretty cool I'm doing soon that I can't talk about. But it's I got something pretty cool. But I'm unemployed after that, so if you're looking for you know, if you need somebody to pretend to be a raccoon, you know, no, I'm Sean Gunn on Twitter, although I don't use it very often, and I'm the Judge Gunn on Instagram, which I love.
Yeah, you use that a lot. And we go to conventions together. We have a great time.
I know, I see conventions, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. Look, this has been a real treat. Let's go take a couple pictures and get you out of here.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy.
Thanks.
Thanks. Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker. Although I didn't really work with her a lot. But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a three-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.